My name is Don Rudrud, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I'm a parish pastor, and our theme this evening is rebuilding the city from Nehemiah's day to Habitat for Humanity. And I should start by saying that I'm a son of a building contractor in small-time building contracting, and I am a carpenter. In fact, you may have noticed under my picture or wherever it is, it says carpenter, and that's what I am up here. I'm a carpenter 3 days a week. I love to build. I don't think I have a Jesus complex about my carpentry, but I am in some ways primarily that, and for this week they've kind of allowed me or drafted me to help teach, and I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed many of you and the private conversations we've had too. I'm very interested in tonight's topic. Maybe it's because I've come by this carpentry pretty much naturally. My dad raised in North Dakota, Hillsboro, the same place where Maydern was from, built a lot of homes in the Depression times, and he came out to California and worked in the Second World War boom times after the GIs came home and house building, and I sort of learned some things about how to build a house and care for a house, and I'm one of those pastors that has bought my own home, and I spent a lot of time working on the house. In fact, expect to get a letter from my wife any day saying, wish you were here to keep fixing some of those things around the house that need to be fixed. I want to talk today about fixing houses and about the basic need of every human being to have a place to live. I even stated rather boldly the last time we were together that I think it's a basic human right that every human being on the face of the earth has a right to decent and adequate housing. You can debate that with me, but I say it out of a concern for the homeless. I learned something since I was with you last. I was listening, dare I confess it out loud, to a radio. And I heard on the radio last night a person talking about the homeless in Seattle. And I was I underestimated the need in Seattle, Washington. They said on the radio last night, on Seattle radio, that there are 2,000 homeless people on the streets of Seattle. 2,000 in Seattle. Now that's more than we have in Minneapolis. I was just overwhelmed by that. But when I start looking at the world situation and really focusing in on not only the refugees of the world, but the fact that probably a fourth of the world lives in substandard or desperate housing situations, and one-fourth of all the human beings, one-fourth of the whole population of the earth does not even have a house to live in. That means that these people are living on the streets, or they're living under some metal or on tar paper or in the ditch. They're living in Calcutta on the streets or on the edges of Mexico City. And more, as we talked about last time, we're seeing them in our own cities, even my city, where hundreds every night sleep near Lake Street along where the railroad tracks run, or sleep in the park a block up from the congregation's place of worship. This means that there are a lot of people that are concerned about what we're talking about tonight, and that's adequate housing. In our own American cities, we know, and we've already talked about, I guess, some of the things that have happened. You cannot avoid it if you really keep your eyes open. In any American city now, you will see houses or buildings that are burned out. You will see places where many houses have been removed by urban renewal, but nothing new has been built. You will see dilapidated, worn-out housing, many times supervised by absentee landlords who find it unprofitable or unwise to fix it up, and so it gets worse and worse until it's condemned and they hope possibly bought up by somebody. I was listening to a tape by Joe Bart, who's taught here many times, and says that the folks that he works with in the black community basically understand urban renewal to be a program to benefit the white folk and not the poor black. Interesting concept. Urban renewal doesn't really benefit the poorest of the poor. But there are all kinds of advantages to us to have the old substandard housing removed. And in cities all over now, we experience gentrification, and the money that is still here going into the development of condominiums and private residences and in my community, hospitals and hospital clinics and all kinds of industry that comes even back into the city. Even the metropolitan domed football stadium is brought into the inner city and replaced hundreds of housing units where people used to live. We put strange priorities. And we don't seem to be prioritizing in any way housing for the poor. Virtually dried up the federal dollar going to this cause. There was a time when we saw public housing being built in America, but now we don't see it. And in fact, some people say that it was a failure and should never be repeated. And in some cases, it was. In cities like St. Louis, they had to finally dynamite down some of the huge housing projects, for they had become jungles in the city. And the fire department wouldn't go there anymore, and the police department couldn't go in to police them. Where do the poor live then? And where will they live in the years that come? It's a troubling question, and I think that the Christian cannot avoid the theme that I'm talking about tonight, and that is that we have been called to rebuild the city. We have been called, among all the other things that we have been called to do, to express the gospel of Jesus Christ by helping people find a place to live. Our religion is not just words about love. It has to do with actions in our life. Or as the people of Habitat for Humanity would call it, we need a theology of the hammer. I want to start, though, with a man named Jeremiah. His name's on the board, not Jeremiah. We've been studying the Bible with Jeremiah this week. I'm going to pick up the story after Jeremiah. For, you know, Jeremiah talked about the time when the people were under judgment of God and being carried off into exile into Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar had carried away their holy vessels out of their temple, and their temple had been destroyed. But then comes this guy, Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, along with Ezra, were the people that felt the call by God to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. We read in the book of Ezra, for example, the call as it came through Cyrus of Persia to spend even the wealth of the Persian power to rebuild this Jewish place of worship back in Jerusalem. A strange concept. To take those sacred vessels, thousands of them, and carry them back over those many miles and put them back into the temple so that the Jews again could worship. And so the first thing to be rebuilt was the temple in Jerusalem. But then comes one of the butlers, one of the servants of the king, named Nehemiah, along with these coming back to the holy place. And Nehemiah senses a great tragedy. He has given it to him almost as a vision from God that the city walls of Jerusalem have been destroyed and the gates of the city have been burned. And he feels the call to rebuild. And he asks his king, who has a strange name, King Artaxerxes, in 448 BC. If he might go to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls. And strange as it may seem, he's given permission to do it. I have a Bible in front of me, and I'm just going to read a few verses. This isn't Bible study, but I think we need to see the basis for what I'm talking about comes right out of our scripture in more than one place. In the book of Nehemiah, let me just read a few verses. Nehemiah says to his king in the second chapter, verse 5, "Send me to Judah, to the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may rebuild it." And then in verse 18 of the same chapter 2, "And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work and began the building." The way they did the building is that Nehemiah was a shrewd organizer, and he organized them in such a way that each family, including the priestly families — the clergy weren't immune from this work — the priestly families and all the families were given certain sections of the wall to rebuild. Remember that famous quote used in the 60s about the Watergate? Well, that's found in here too. One of the families was given the task of rebuilding the Watergate, but there were other places to be rebuilding. And each of them then worked side by side. here's what Nehemiah himself did. It says, Nehemiah the son of Azbuk, ruler of half the district of Bethsur, repaired to the point opposite the sepulchres of David, to the artificial pool and to the house of the mighty man. That's in verse 16 of chapter 3. And in chapter 4, just skipping along, it says they were building the wall. And some critics came along. And the critics said this, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that? These words could be said to many who struggle in our inner cities to make sense of the burned out wasteland, battle zone that is left after urban decay and civil disorder and government neglect. What a pleading cry. Will they revive the stones out of the heap of rubbish and burned ones at that? Well, obviously, Nehemiah felt that they would. He continued to drive and encourage. He was an activist in every sense of the word, and through sheer courage and faith in God, the job was done. But there was a problem developed, that it's a very important problem, and we must pause to look at that before we set aside this biblical account. For along with the workers, there were the Jewish merchant class that saw in the task the opportunity to exchange money and to loan it for interest. And they lent to the poor at high rates of interest and exploited them. In the very time when the people were trying to get themselves together again as a nation and rebuild their city, there comes a time of greed and taking advantage of the poor. And we find this in the fifth chapter of Nehemiah. It says in chapter 5, verse 10, moreover, I and my brethren and my servants are lending them money and grain, but now let us leave off this interest. And in verse 12, then they said, we will restore these and require nothing from them. Nehemiah's word was to stop the charging of interest, to stop the use of usury, to lend money for gain. Now, this isn't the only time we're going to find this one in the scripture. I always find that biblical fundamentalists have trouble explaining this to me. They may be good capitalists, but they can't explain all those scriptures that tell us that we should not charge interest. But this was a clear violation of everything that the people stood for. It wasn't just charging interest to the rich, it was charging interest to the very poorest, in order that they might get their supplies to do their share of the work to rebuild the city. And Nehemiah says, enough of that stuff. And so they stop charging interest to the poor, and they complete the task, and they have a great celebration, celebrating the fact that not only is all of the walls rebuilt, but their temple is rebuilt. They rededicated in a style very similar to the style of the first dedication when King Solomon was around. Not only that, they read at the installation an important document that had been discovered in the process. The document was the Law of Moses. And Nehemiah is famous not just for the rebuilding of the city, but for helping that Jewish community get back again to its roots, to its religious roots, to what it meant to be the people of the covenant and the people that had been promised so much from God. Their rebuilding had very much to do with their worship life. And once it was rebuilt, they had lots to celebrate. Now that Nehemiah concept has been carried on into 1986 in the inner cities. In my neighborhood in Minneapolis, Minnesota, we celebrate Nehemiah's Day 6-7 times every summer, and now in the fall at least 3 or 4 times. What happens at Nehemiah's Day? At Nehemiah's Day, people in local churches on an ecumenical basis gather together to rebuild a little part of the city. Maybe my church can only produce 4 or 5 volunteers, but they are paired together with a young people's group from the suburbs of maybe 25, and maybe a couple from the local Catholic church. And we gather on Friday night to study the scripture, to pray together, and to learn about the city and why housing has deteriorated the way it has. And then Saturday morning, first thing, gather for breakfast, and as if you're getting a work assignment at Holden Village, off we go into the community to work all day long. Nehemiah's day is working. Local people in the community are beginning to sense that we're for real when we say we're willing to come and help an elderly woman paint her house, or to help a Catholic church tear down an old garage that's been an eyesore in their community and haven't known how to do away with it, or to just be involved in picking up a big old vacant lot that's filled with all kinds of junk, a thing that we're going to do a little bit of this coming Monday here to take care of some of the junk of this village. At times, Nehemiah Day gets us involved in even new construction where we're helping to build on something or to repair a roof. They're modest projects, but they teach the biblical concept that we are called to rebuild the city, and we can do that under God as a ministry of God. The exciting thing has been that those people in the suburbs that have joined in have been freed finally from their suburban captivity. Gibson Winter wrote that book way back in the 60s about the suburban captivity of American Protestantism. We have found ourselves, as Joe Barnes says, living in a white ghetto. We're living isolated from the poor. We're living isolated from the problems of the city. And people have had their eyes opened by getting into a home where people have trouble heating it, and where there is tremendous need for insulation, or when we see elderly people living in situations where they desperately need some younger people to just help them keep the place safe. And so people come out of that suburban captivity, like the people of Israel so many years came back to Jerusalem, into the city with Nehemiah, and they have their eyes opened, and they come back again and again. Now, that little plan that's happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota this summer under the leadership of Pastor Keith Olstead and the neighborhood churches acting together, a community organization of some 16 churches, is something that can happen in your community too. It's not hard. It's a very simple plan. Maybe you know of something like it, and in a minute I'd like you to tell me something of what you know is going on in your community. But let's talk about a couple of other places. I've put them on the board. Places that I know a little bit about, but probably some of you know more than I. Jubilee Housing, a part of the work of the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., comes out of a long history of ministry that goes back many years. The pastor, Gordon Crosby and his associates, especially Elizabeth Connor, who's written the book that I referred you to and some of you may have looked at by now, is a community that's done some amazing things. They have committed themselves to the inner city of Washington, D.C. They've started a coffee house where people come and relate and share conversation and good food, something not unlike St. Martin's Table in Minneapolis. But out of that has grown all kinds of other ministries, and actually it's multiplied into several little congregations. One of the ministries that grew out of that fellowship of the Church of the Savior was the decision that there needed to be something done about absentee landlords in Washington, D.C., who were not fixing up their apartments. Many people were living in apartments with no heat all winter long. There was all kinds of code violations, rodent violations. And Christian people who had many times not seen this kind of urban poverty before now found themselves coming to the coffee house and to worship with the Christians of the Church of our Savior, and they couldn't avoid anymore what was going on in the houses around them. And so what they did is they began to do something very bold. One of their Christian community went out and got a real estate license. She didn't know too much about urban housing issues, but she got her license. And then she began to contact some of the absentee landlords and find out what was motivating them. And although she didn't tell them that she had no money, they didn't tell her that they were very anxious to get rid of the properties. And before long, the Church of our Savior was offered the opportunity to buy one of the buildings. It had a strange name. The name was the Ritz. But it wasn't a Ritz anymore. It was filled with all black people living way below the poverty line. There was all kinds of drug and alcohol abuse. There had been people killed and hurt all around the building. It was a tough situation. But when the pastor of the church and the people of the community began to talk more and more about what they felt called to do, they very boldly decided that they would make an offer on the building. They would buy it and somehow find the capital. And they would try to demonstrate in that one building that a more humane community could be created and people could care for the residents that lived there, and there could be some sense of turning over the ownership of that building to the people of the community. And Pastor Crosby got into his congregation, it was in the Christmas season, and challenged them to spend part of the time they normally went out Christmas shopping to come over and scrape away old paint and fix plumbing and work to get that place in shape. It was forced on them, you see, because 2 days after signing the paper, they were slapped with 900 code violations by the Washington, D.C. They had tremendous work to do, and they learned a lot. They learned a lot about how difficult it is to bring a building up to code. They learned about how in old buildings you can't easily just replace things that have long since gone out of manufacture. They learned that you have to get permits. They learned that it's not so easy to work right side by side with people that are already living in the building who don't understand your motivation and what you're doing. And when you try to show them that you're not the same kind of landlord as they've always had, they don't quickly understand that either. But they began slowly but surely to work side by side with the people of the building. They created an organization called Jubilee Housing, which eventually has purchased several buildings in that community. They developed a place of hospitality, a kind of restaurant in each of the buildings, community organizations within the building so the people could get together and solve their own problems. They eventually turned over the running of the building to the people who lived in the buildings. And they always struggle with the issue of, are they being paternalistic, kind of do-gooders, or are they liberating people from the terror of living in awful housing? Well, there's much to learn from that model. It's one that intrigues me, and if you have a chance to be in the Washington, D.C. area, I hope you will join a growing long line of Christian people from all over the world that have come to the Church of the Savior to see that creative ministry. But that's sort of out of the Lutheran tradition. Let's come a little closer to home. This one, probably some of you know well. I'm sure that you've heard of Ruth Youngdahl Nelson. And the film about her called Mother of the Year will be shown next week if you're still here. But do you know about some of her famous children? Do you know about her son, I believe, named John, who was a pastor in Washington, D.C.? Is he the one? He's the one in Seattle. Okay, that's right. It's actually her husband who was a pastor in Washington, D.C., and she and her husband were in an integrated congregation, very boldly integrating that congregation long before Lutherans talked very much about that, gave a faithful and strong ministry that took them to many places in the world. But the son that you've heard about is the one involved in the Trident submarine protest, but you maybe haven't heard so much about Mary, the daughter, and her brother, whose name... is it Bob?
David.
David and Mary both committed themselves in the 1960s to be in an all-black neighborhood in Chicago. I've been there. It's the kind of neighborhood where, even though I'm 6'5" and fairly healthy, I didn't feel so comfortable walking around. I was the only white face, and it included some of the worst stuff that you can imagine in the city. Pastor Nelson talks about when he first arrived, it was a time of the great disturbances in Chicago, and there was shooting on the streets, and there were burnings in the neighborhood, and there were National Guard through his parish, and he wasn't sure what was going to happen. He lost quickly all of the remaining white members, and he had to start building pretty much from scratch. But what they built at Bethel Church in that part of Chicago is an amazing story. They've built not only a strong worshiping community of people that love their church and see themselves as Lutheran, but they've built employment, jobs for people working in small cottage industries. They've taken over one after another of the neighborhood buildings and rehabilitated them. They've leveraged federal monies, and so they've built new buildings in an old, dilapidated neighborhood. And when you go there now, you get the sense that it's just going on and on and on. Mary especially, I think, has been a bold leader. And that brave woman of faith has taken on everybody from the mayor of Chicago to the Lutheran Brotherhood Life Insurance Company to somehow get money committed to the poor and to go by the slogan that she wears boldly, like her mother did, bread, not bombs. This should be our priority as a people. And I believe both she and her brother are single and have not been married. And I think this kind of commitment that they have made as celibate people in that community is for real. They've been there a lot of years, and the people know that they're there with them. It isn't broadly known, but they've had some real tough times. Mary herself has been raped in her community. They have gone through violent situations. But they continue that ministry, and it's in the name of the Lutheran Church, it's of the LCA tradition, and it's a tribute to Ruth Youngdahl Nelson, their mother. Now that's one more I wanted you to know about. But the one that probably I personally am involved in right now and want to share with a little of my own enthusiasm is something called Habitat for Humanity. May have heard of, well, let's just see, show of hands, so I'll kind of see. How many of you have heard of Habitat for Humanity? Second question, how many of you know who Clarence Jordan is or was? Clarence Jordan. Not so many. How about if I mention the Cotton Cats translation of the gospel? Does that sound familiar? Okay. In the 1960s, I became aware of that translation of the Bible, and I probably mainly connected Clarence Jordan with that because it was a fresh way of looking at scriptures, especially written from the point of view of someone in the state of Georgia and coming out of that southern situation. I sort of, as a smug Minneapolis northerner, thought, well, he's writing about those issues of racism that those folks down in Georgia have got to deal with. He wrote the Good Samaritan story and had the Good Samaritan as a black man, and have the white gospel preacher walking right by on the other side and all that stuff. But I've learned more about Clarence Jordan since then. I've learned of his courage. I've learned that he lived in an integrated community called Koinonia Farms there in that area, not too far from Plains, Georgia, America's Georgia, in a time when black people and white people just didn't live together in the same kind of a community, like a little Holden village. Some people say, why don't we have more black people up here at Holden Village? I wonder if it would happen, if that did happen, that we would be called, like Jordan was, a communist. Because he was living in a community alongside and with black people. The Ku Klux Klan took him on. He was shot at. There was violence acts done to him and to their crops. And at times the persecution got so intense that a community of several dwindled down to just two families. But in all this time, Clarence Jordan continued to be a farmer and a student of the Bible. He had been trained as a Baptist in theological training, and he was a good student of the Greek language and knew how to translate that scripture. And he studied that scripture by lantern light and continued to present it in a way that was real to those poor people all around him. And believe me, I don't know, any of you been in the area around Plains, Georgia? What do you notice about the housing around there? You know, it's shacks. I mean, this is some of the worst and most obvious poverty ever. You know, it just, for some of us who have lived in the north, it kind of blows your mind to just start driving by and understand that these people live in this kind of situation. Half of the housing in the county where Clarence Jordan was doing this work was substandard housing, half of it. Now, not too far away is the home of Jimmy Carter. That's pretty nice, although I was surprised when I saw it to see that it's just a middle-class home. It's not any great shakes, but it's real luxurious in that part of the world. Well, Clarence Jordan had a great influence on some people. Some people in those times who were concerned about the civil rights movement. And especially had a great influence on a man named Millard Fuller. I feel privileged to have met Millard Fuller and to hear him speak. Maybe you have too. How many of you know that name, Millard Fuller? Fairly new name. I just happen to have, thank you, June, 3 books by Millard. And although I don't think they're in the library yet, nor are they in the bookstore, we're going to get one of them. I think this one in the bookstore. It's called Love in the Mortar Joints. And this one is called Bokatola, which is an African word, and you'll have to read the book to find out about Millard's experience in Zaire in Africa. And this one called No More Shacks. Millard Fuller's got quite a story. He was raised in Alabama. He was a very smart young man, very enterprising, certainly part of straight out of the American tradition of hard work ethic and creative ingenuity, a brilliant mind. He was making so much money, even by the time he graduated from college, that his IRS report would make mine look like poverty. I mean, this guy figured out ways to make money out of everything. He was climbing up in trees and pulling down mistletoe and selling mistletoe and picking up junk off the ground and gluing it together. And I don't know, he was just figuring out all kinds of ways to do things. And by the time Millard was 30 years old, he had made his first $1 million. And he made more than that. This guy knew how to leverage money. He knew how to do all the stuff you got to do. He got his business degree, and he got the experience you need in the context to go. The sky was the limit. He worked night and day. He was a workaholic. Now, he and his wife were raised Christian, and they were part of a Christian tradition, and his wife was, like many women in those years, in a situation of spending a lot of time raising children, and she talks about times she was so lonely and so frustrated that she just got out and wheeled the child in the baby carriage for hours until she got so tired she just went home and dropped asleep, and no Millard, he wasn't there. He had flown off to some business meeting. She finally, after much prayer and deliberation, got to the point where she couldn't take it anymore, and she asked him one night to talk, and she says, I got to tell you something. She says, I decided I got to get away for a while and think some things over. I'm not sure I want to be married to you anymore. And sure enough, she flew off to New York City to counsel with a pastor who had some influence on them. And Millard found himself at home with the kids. So he hired a private plane, had a private pilot take him up to New York City. And I don't remember all the details, but I remember one of the details was that they sat on the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan and talked and talked and talked. And he came to the conclusion that there had to be a radical change in his life. And they were under the influence of the Spirit of God, and both of them prayed together. And he decided that the only thing that was right for him was to give away all of his wealth and to start over again in a new commitment to his marriage and to living their life in service to others and not for himself. And within a week, by a strange quirk of circumstance and the Spirit of God, he found himself sitting in a humble little place called Americus, Georgia, talking to Clarence Jordan. He just stopped by to visit a friend. Actually, he wasn't going to stay, but he ended up staying for months, maybe years. Clarence Jordan knew something about the Bible and knew something about what the Christian faith was all about. He talked about the economics of Jesus. And this capitalistic-trained, successful man learned some things about the Bible he had never seen before. He certainly learned what it meant to sell all you have and give to the poor. For he started to, through telephone conversations and through his lawyers, to give away to charitable institutions all of his millions. He just unloaded it all. And he and his wife and family, now living in this simple, predominantly black community of Georgia, traveled by bicycle and lived in an old, dilapidated house and did volunteer things like sort pecans, because they grew pecans, and to talk long into the night about Jesus and what Jesus has to say about the poor. Well, Millard Fuller eventually had to go through the sad thing of facing the untimely and soon death of his dear friend Clarence Jordan. The Ku Klux Klan had such control of that community that the medical inspector refused to come out, the morgue refused to come out, and Millard had to take his friend Clarence Jordan and put a sheet over him and put him back on the station wagon to take him in so he'd get a death certificate so they could bury him in the farm under the pecan trees. But there had been something happening in this family, and it wasn't just Millard, but it was his wife too. The two of them had become so committed, they felt the call to mission, the call to care for the poor, and they committed themselves to go on an overseas mission to Zaire in Africa. And there they saw the great need of the people was housing. Hundreds of people living in terrible situations, many of them without any housing at all. They devised ways, and Millard had this brilliant mind and organizational skill, devised ways to, in a simple way, with simple construction, local materials, to build houses for very little. They could build a very adequate house with a separate room for cooking so that the smoke would not get into the sleeping areas for less than $2,000. The whole thing complete. And not only that, he leveraged money that he could get back from the Koinonia Farms, where there was still a community loyal to the teachings and to the leadership of what Clarence Jordan had represented. And they took that money and used it as seed money to begin to develop a program where people could, in Zaire, borrow money in order that they might build their house with the idea that they should then pay back the money. That was something new for a people in an African tribal area, to pay back money on some kind of a mortgage, on a simple house that you would have and own yourself. It seemed like somebody was trying to transport capitalism into the midst of a different culture, but it seemed to work. Now, some people thought, oh, we'll just stop making payments and they'll never get us, but when the payments began to stop, Millard ordered that all construction stop and made it clear to everybody that there's no way they could keep on with this project unless the people took the ownership of themselves and provided the basic support to keep it going. And so the payments began again in a simple way, very small payments, but the people began to own it themselves. What was demonstrated in Africa was brought back by Millard when he came back to this country, and that was in a period in the late 1970s. There, in long conversations with people of like mind in the Koinonia Farms, it was decided that somehow this concept of people putting small amounts of money down to have ownership of their own house and working together with others to voluntarily build that house might be a way to deal with the tremendous housing crunch not only in Zaire but all over the world. And so Habitat for Humanity was born. A basic concept of partners was developed. People like Millard, who had contacts in the business community, went out and sought capital, sought money that would either be given them or be loaned them at no interest in order that initial supplies could be purchased and initial construction begun in new homes. They wanted to target especially the area around Americus, where there were so many people living in substandard housing. The idea was to help those poor sharecroppers, those poor folks that had owed their soul to the company store, to somehow have their own place to live. And to this day, over 200 homes have been now built for them and many more rehabilitated. It worked. People caught the vision. They listened to the words of Jesus. And the words of Jesus implied that they had to do something about housing. The idea of no-interest loans became a hallmark of Habitat for Humanity. The economics of Jesus, could it really work? Is it craziness, or would it work that people could be lent money with no interest and they'd rapidly pay it back? And then when they paid it back, that money could be used to build something else. A fund for humanity was established. And I was going to try to put it on the board here. because I think the principles, if we can kind of remember these principles of the fund, might be important for you to remember. Number one, the principle was that the poor would be owners. Just to apply that to the neighborhood I live in now, in the near south side of Minneapolis, we are now called the highest concentration of poverty in the whole city of Minneapolis. 82% of the people in my neighborhood are renters. 82% are renters. These poor people do not own their own homes. And they do not put roots in the community, and they do not put pride in the community if they know that they are only passing through, or if they know that no matter what they do, they may not get the absentee landlord to really care about them. And they don't seem to find a way to own their own home either. The poor were to be owners in this project. Secondly, it was to be not for profit. The profit idea was out. Clarence Jordan was accused of being a communist. But he had trouble supporting dog-eat-dog capitalism out of the Bible, and I challenge you to support it there too. What seems to be implied is that we must care for our neighbor and not exploit the poor. The third was the concept of a no-interest loan. Sounds pretty nice. But it's almost the only way that people that are living below the poverty level can really afford to get involved in a mortgage. The concept was they really would be given a payment they could afford, even if they were receiving public assistance, and that payment would become then a revolving fund that would go out on the next loan, and the next, and it would multiply. Not only were there to be a no-interest loan, but an expectation, at least in my city in Habitat for Humanity, was that there be volunteer labor. And that labor was to be done by the actual people who would live in the home. The requirement would be on the house that they were to move into, they were to serve with 250 hours. If they had children in the family, the children could help fulfill that. But after they moved into the house that was fixed up for them, then they were required to do another 100 hours on the home for the next family. And so it multiplied. But not only would they work in their own home that they would live in, but there would be hundreds of other volunteers begin to be involved in many of these projects to work side by side with them. So an electrician would give a few hours on a Saturday, or someone that had special skills in knowing how to scrape paint would come and work along with the person who didn't know how. And many, many volunteers could become involved. And the project caught people's imagination. People that are like you and I, that maybe haven't lived in this kind of a situation or really haven't really known much about what it might be to be black, found that they could work side by side with a poor black person in Georgia or in San Antonio with an Hispanic person or up in New York City, and to feel good about the partnership that was developing. The more rich were learning from the poor, and the poor were learning from the rich, and they met as equals. It wasn't charity. In fact, I'd like to quote from Millard Fuller, two beautiful quotes. If you don't remember any of my other quotes, listen to these. People who are economically poor need capital, not charity. They need capital, not charity. They need co-workers instead of caseworkers. Co-workers instead of caseworkers. Well, I guess I've got most of them, except I want to remind you of that basic concept that the house payment was to be recycled. They got this idea straight out of their understanding in Clarence Jordan's translation of the miracle of the loaves and fishes. Some people would call it a parable of the loaves and fishes. There was a way that people said it can't be done. We can't feed them. There's just too many people out here. We can't do it. It's an overwhelming problem. Let's give up. How many times have we said that about the housing issues? But Jesus saw the possibility. And Jesus somehow shared that kind of vision with those disciples, and so that they began to pass out the food and there were all those basketfuls left over. It's that concept of the multiplication that became and is still to this day the exciting thing about Habitat for Humanity. For now it's expanded into over 200 American communities and over 16 nations all over the world. And you're hearing about it here just like people today are hearing about it all over. This is a growing movement. It's a group movement that does not depend on federal dollars or federal subsidies. It is paid for by Christian people. It is a movement dedicated to the glory of God, biblically rooted. And it's a movement that even Lutherans are finding out about. I must admit, Lutherans haven't been the greatest upfront leaders in the program. In fact, sometimes Lutherans get a little bit uncomfortable when you're around people like Miller, because he's praying a lot and talking a lot about the Holy Spirit and encouraging the man who came to him that sold life insurance to say, hey, the way you're talking, my whole life's been oriented wrong. I've been selling people all kinds of things to tell them that they're going to die, and they gotta store their money away in barns, and you're teaching me about something about consider the lilies of the field, and you're teaching me to put my money not in protecting myself, but in my neighbor. But Lutherans have become involved, and every Christian group has become involved, and I suppose some non-Christians become involved. It's especially attractive to young adults. In fact, young adults here at Holden have told me they've considered strongly, after leaving here, maybe going to America's Georgia and just kind of living in for a while at the Koinonia Farms. By the way, we're in a building called Koinonia. It's a good word. Christian community, the people called the fellowship. I told you that they don't get all hung up in Koinonia or in Habitat for Humanity about theological arguments, or we find that we're working a lot with Baptists that have a different understanding of baptism, but our theology isn't to kind of get us to argue about baptism. We gather together around the theology of the hammer. We gather together about a concern for housing. Now, I'm on the board of Habitat for Humanity in the city of Minneapolis, and I'm proud and happy to say that now Minneapolis has a chapter of Habitat for Humanity. We're now into our second house. What is the process? First of all, the way it's been set up, there's no big national organization or national money. It's all local. If your community wants to have Habitat for Humanity, you do it. And you do it by getting your own group of Christian people together to start praying about it and doing something about it. By the way, if you'd like to find out how to do that, all you have to do is write 418 West Church Street. That's the address. And it's America's Georgia, U.S. America's Georgia, and I think the zip code is 31709. Now, even if you're in a community where your housing is in great shape, and I would guess in almost every community there's still need for housing for the poor, you may find a way that you can get involved in this project. I think for retired people, for example, it's an ideal way for you to spend some of your free time. Let me tell you about one retired person who spent a lot of time along with his wife. His name is Jimmy Carter. Have you heard about Jimmy? As the former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter could have been on the boards of the greatest corporations in America. He could have been anything he wanted to be in our government. But he very carefully chooses. He chooses to spend his time on the Carter Library. He teaches at Emory University. But he's on one board of directors. That's because this guy named Millard Fuller continued to bug him and finally sat with he and Rosalind in their apartment just about 15 miles away from America's, I guess. And Jimmy Carter is on the board of directors of Habitat for Humanity. And not only that, he's on the board in such a way that he says, I want to be a working board member ever. I don't want to have my name on here. What do you need? And he was told, you could use some help. You know, you're a pretty good carpenter, and Jimmy is. Could use some help now in some of these work days. We could use some help if you wanted to be a spokesperson on behalf of this organization. You've got some credibility in the community. And so you've seen him in the media. He's been up in New York City on Manhattan Island working. He's been working in many places in the country. And Rosalind, too. They've been committed. In fact, let me just take a little bit to read something that Jimmy Carter said, because I really kind of like this. And thanks you to June for giving me all this stuff, because she really helped me with this. It says, even for a former president, it isn't easy to find a project that is at the same time exciting, somewhat controversial, inspirational, challenging, unpredictable, extremely worthwhile, highly successful, and international in scope. But such is Habitat for Humanity. I have chosen not to serve on any boards of directors of corporations or get involved in any outside commercial activities. I am very busy now and so on, but I have also found time to become an active director of Habitat, and Rosalind serves as one of his advisors. Last page says, talks about his work experiences, especially up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and he says, these work experiences have also let us learn a lot about ourselves and about each other. I have done carpentry and cabinet work since I was a young farm boy, but Rosalind and most of our volunteers had never sawed a board or driven a large nail with a hammer. Within a few hours, they were performing work of a fairly advanced nature. Furthermore, my wife has never been more beautiful than when her face was covered with black smut from scraping burned ceiling joists and streaked with sweat from carrying full sheets of heavy plywood from the street level to the floor where we were working. In charge of a small group of workers, she made intricate measurements, cut subflooring with a power saw, and nailed it down with just a few hard hammer blows. I like that, because that's what I've been doing lately. Right here, building those big boxes down the way for our ecology. What? We're going to recycle aluminum and other kinds of metal in those big boxes. If Jimmy Carter was sitting here today, I think he would give you an enthusiastic sermon about what Habitat for Humanity has meant. He's had a chance to visit the projects in Africa and see what's going on there. He continues to keep excited, and many people do. The thing captures people's imagination. There's a way, there's really something we can do. Yeah.
Who handles the paperwork, the banking for the... in Georgia?
No, it isn't handled in some kind of a net. All they've got in America's Georgia is just this kind of a couple little storefronts in this little primitive building. I was in Plains, Georgia when Jimmy Carter was president, just wanted to see what the town looked like. And boy, that's a humble part of it. You know, it's just a very humble area there. But the way they do it, let's talk about the Minneapolis organization. We have a voluntary board that's created in Minneapolis. There are Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists and all kinds of folks, black and white, that are on this board. They set up their own bank account. They set up their own committee structure. One of the committees is just to get volunteers, to find the electricians and the plumbers. Another group is to find the capital or the donation of the first property. I'm on a third group. My group is to select the family. And we get the word out in the community of Minneapolis that there is a possibility of owning your own home if you're low income, and that you'll have to pay, let's say, a mortgage of, instead of $500 every month, you have to pay a mortgage of $200 a month. And we say these are the things we're looking for. We don't discriminate if they have a particular religious background. We will not even discriminate if they are not Christian. But it's obviously a Christian program that we're representing. What happened in Minneapolis is the Lutheran Deaconess Hospital, connected with the Fairview Hospital Corporation, donated to us a house that they owned in the neighborhood. That was a beautiful gift to get it started. And so we didn't have to put out that capital to get started. But we needed a lot of money to fix up the house, because it was in such terrible shape that they would have had to put thousands in it to pay professionals to come and do it. So we organized volunteer crews to come in and clean it, volunteer groups to put a new roof on it. It's not unlike Holden Village. Look at all the volunteer work up here. You know, these people that are doing all this work up here, they're not getting paid salaries. They're just doing it as volunteers. Well, you can take that volunteer concept of Holden Village and put it into the inner cities. The people then did their work. Some people said, I can't come and give some hours, but I will give some dollars. And so the dollars built up in the bank. That's managed by a local committee, and I'm not positive of this, but I would assume that they have an auditing procedure. I know they have an annual meeting. Their books are completely open, and they're audited and so on. Now we've just gotten into our second house. I was on the screening committee. We interviewed some 25 families in person. And when we got down to the five finalists, we interviewed them three different times. We interviewed them in their home. We found out about their need. We had certain criteria. One of them was need. Another criteria was whether the family size fit the size of the house we were fixing up. Another one, did they look like they really were ready to go to work as volunteers and put in that 250 hours plus the other 100 hours? And we also looked in our first family for someone who would be willing to face the media and somewhat PR this, because we knew that the word would spread in the Twin Cities and they should be able to speak for it. We found a Lutheran woman a block from our church. She wasn't a member of my congregation. She was divorced, a practical nurse with limited income. She had three teenage children, and we couldn't have found a better one. She loved the neighborhood where we were building the house. And by the way, for those of you who know Minneapolis, the house is located just about four doors away from the old Deaconess Hospital. She was ready to go to work. She was a little shy about getting up in the public, but she said, I have been a leader in my church, and I do want people to know that I'm sold on this program. Now, she's been discouraged over the last several months because the house hasn't been ready as fast as we wanted. You know, we got hung up on building inspector, we got certain skills that we couldn't find, but to my knowledge, she's now moved in and we're ready to go on the second house. She's starting to make her payment. She makes her payment, and as that money comes in, we manage it carefully so that we can use it for supplies for the second house. There is a stipulation that she must sign, and that is that she can't just quickly go out and sell the house. If she does sell, she has to give us first option, so that we might continue that house in the hands of the poor and of the people that we was designed to serve. But in all over the United States, the overwhelming experience has been that these people remain homeowners and do not quickly move out of this place that now they can call their own. Yeah.
Have you seen any write-up of this in the Lutheran Standard?
I haven't, but I
don't. The reason why I ask is that we were in Tucson, and the Lutheran church there were involved, and I don't know if those other churches involved too, but they had built several houses,
yeah.
And they had written to a Lutheran Standard for a story, and they wouldn't print it. Maybe it's because it was because of a combination of faiths. I don't know, but I was wondering if they had
I don't know that. I do know that the Lutheran Church in America has two of their pastors and are leaders on the National Board for Habitat Humanity, so they seem to have been more in it than the American Lutheran Church. I think for my tradition, which is basically Norwegian and German, upper Midwest, this stuff is pretty foreign. We just have not been into it. We've been pretty isolated. But for those who live in America's Georgia or in the Bronx or in San Antonio, Texas, I mean, these things are just, they have to be dealt with. They're just key agendas for the Christian community.
Well, they were so enthused about it down there, and they wanted to give it more publicity to the church papers.
Mm-hmm. I wanna let maybe you say some things about your experience in Boston, but also anybody else to say something. But I just thought I'd read you one other, this is almost kind of fun to read, from the newspaper that June gave me of Habitat. And you can, by the way, subscribe to this. It's called Habitat World. This is their most recent issue in June of 1986. And this little article is called The 10-Hour Miracle House Raised. It's kind of fun to read about miracles. Debbie said, I'm stunned. Dana commented, this is unusual. I responded, I didn't believe it would be possible. Dana's was an understatement of the year, for Tri-County Habitat for Humanity had just completed framing and roofing its second house in Pennsylvania. On Friday afternoon, April 11th, 1986, there wasn't one stick of wood erected. By Saturday, 10 working hours later, the downstairs partitions had been put up, sills laid around the foundation, the first floor plywood nailed in place, the four walls put together and raised, the trusses nailed in place, the plywood put on the trusses, and the black tar paper nailed down. The workers never stopped except for a 5-minute break. I might add parenthetically, I worked for Wilderness Canoe Base in the Canadian border, and once we built a cabin in one day, so I know it can be done when you got a lot of enthusiastic volunteers. All were unpaid volunteers, with the exception of the foreman. We had a highly skilled contractors working without pay, besides unskilled workers eager to learn and needing a decent house to live in. Among the builders with community work experience program participants and prisoners from the center jail who worked as hard as anyone. The prisoners received 2 days off their sentence for each day's work. The neighbors' children helped sweep the floor. Wealthy middle class and poor people worked together in partnership. 5 volunteers came from the Mount Joy Mennonite Church, 3 hours from the project site. We all knew how hard Mennonites work, and we saw this house raising with our own eyes. And believe me, the work party from Mount Joy was as tickled with their handiwork as Debbie, the future homeowner. Debbie and her 2 children were there too, little Craig and Colette, will have a decent home for the first time in their lives. And this is what Habitat at All is all about, helping those who have never had a decent place to live without adding profit or interest. A miracle happened in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. You had to be there.
I might add a couple of things about Tucson.
Yeah.
Habitat. One is that the city donates the land for $1 a lot, because they convince the city-owned land that they can get taxes off of this something to build on. The city became so enthusiastic that they, 1 year, underwrote one of the houses for $30,000, and with the idea that Habitat would pay that back. Habitat, that's against one of the policies to accept that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
But the city, again, just was showing that kind of enthusiasm. They still had the problem of permits and some construction haggles and all the other things that normally go with a building in the city. So I think they're on their 10th or 11th house now. So they're getting to the point that they're getting enough income per month to underwrite some of their building and taking some of the pressure so they can build a little bit faster. I think they have 2 or 3 scheduled for this coming winter.
Long ago, Habitat passed their goal of having a new house dedicated every day of the year.
The other thing about volunteers, we have, last year I think we had 3 Lutheran family volunteers that were staying there for 4 to 6 months. There's a real advantage to that because there's a continuity of volunteers. If you can have 2 or 3 people that are there for the entire construction of the house, there's continuity, and when there's a gap in terms of getting very temporary volunteers, they can fill in. Or many times there's some quiet periods that they can do some very limited work. And the other thing is that they develop a very strong sense of Christian community. And there may be maybe 3 or 4 faith contributions to that house. And every one of those volunteer families come back and say how they've grown during the winter and how they took away more than they gained. So those opportunities are all over the country.
They had some opportunity down there with there's snowbirds that are able-bodied that they're looking for to do something, and that helped a lot.
I think of my own father. He had a heart condition. He retired early as a carpenter, but he wanted to do something. He just couldn't sit around. And so he ended up having a job similar to what you're talking about over at our church. They were doing an addition on the church, and he became the resident kind of contractor. He sort of just lived in there, and he couldn't do a lot of labor, but he kind of helped make it happen. And he coordinated the volunteers. But if Habitat had been around and my dad could have been involved in that, it would have been right up his alley and in his retirement. He could have worked with people and shared his kind of skill and enthusiasm. And what I think so many people are hungry for in the church is to do something. Not just to deal with words and concepts, but to do the Christian faith. And I'm coming to the conclusion that isn't just our young adults who are getting kind of turned off by the institutional church, but that's older people too. I told you about the lady the other day, age 75, who came and worked in our shelter for the homeless and said it was the only time she'd really been challenged and excited by her Christian life ever since she'd been a Christian. And she was working now at 75 in the shelter for the homeless. You know, the Bible tells about it in John, let your religion not just be in words, but in action. And Luther talked about it in terms of faith, active in love. I think we're onto something here that may be an answer to a world that has got a shrinking federal dollar and shrinking commitment to public monies. by the way, the church has got some money we can put into housing. Let's not be so quick to let ourselves as an institution get off. I happen to be a part of a struggling church, but we've got a foundation. We're 117 years old. We've got a foundation. And monies from our foundation can be lent at no interest or at very small interest, and so we're starting to do that. We've lent to the local neighborhood organization that's helping people to be homeowners in our neighborhood out of our foundation.